I will open the Senate Committee on Rules for February 11th, 2010. We are going to go a little bit out of the order and go to opening a public hearing on SR3. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview, and could General Caldwell come forward?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Resolution 3 honors the 41st Infantry Brigade Combat Team of Oregon National Guard for the service in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Okay. General Caldwell, would you please identify yourself for the record and give your presentation?
Mr. Chairman and member of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to come here this morning. I'm on my way out of town to catch an airplane, so I really do appreciate you rearranging the schedule just enough so I can at least give the testimony, some testimony on this resolution. As you may or may not know, I know you know, I suppose the audience doesn't, nor does the folks on the TV know, that the 41st Brigade is currently our 41st Brigade, which is headquartered in Tigard and consists of units literally from the California border to the Washington border, mainly up and down I-5, and also, excuse me, a battalion in Bend. They're currently deployed to Iraq. They're going to be coming home in May. This is the largest single deployment of Oregon National Guard members or units since World War II. There's roughly 3,400 soldiers in this organization. 2,800 of those are Oregonians. The others come from other states that were invited to help fill our requirement. This unit has got a storied history. It's part of the, as the resolution depicts and well states, that it this unit was one of the most important units in the Pacific Theater in World War II when it was a division. In World War II, the division consisted of units out of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. And that unit was sent to the Pacific right after December 7th, 1941, went into Australia to defend Australia and then worked their way up through the island campaign and became the one of the longest-serving divisions in U.S. Army history without relief because of the type of situation they were in. So it's got a good deal of history to it. They've done an outstanding job in Iraq. In the mission that they've had, unfortunately, we've had two soldiers were killed from an IED early on in their deployment. And they've done some masterful things with respect to what's going on over there right now. Just to give you one quick story that I think you might enjoy is that the one of their members is executive for FedEx. Now, I was going to say UPS, but I'm sure it's FedEx. And one of their jobs, and their primary job, is to guard convoys, is to escort convoys all over the country. They are scattered literally all over the country in different cells. And they we were having quite a few IEDs that were seemed to be hitting them on a regular basis. And this soldier/FedEx employee, when he's home, said, you know, I think we can do this better if we just use some of the software that I got my friends to send me from the United States that we use in FedEx. And he redesigned the entire delivery system so they had less chance of people getting consistency and knowing their routes. And it became the model for the entire nation, for the whole United States Army in Iraq, because of this lack of consistency. And he could get he got more efficiency out of the program, and he also managed to cause a situation where they weren't static and doing the same thing over and over. So I think it's another example of where the citizen soldiers do such a wonderful job of bringing their skills from Main Street into an army slash military situation, which I think depicts well how, you know, why the Guard in the Reserve are such an important and integral part of our military forces. This resolution couples up with May 8th, with the legislature last session passed as a Military Family Appreciation Day, and first time that's happened in the state of Oregon. So by taking this resolution and keying on that May 8th day, I think we've combined two good things for the state and honor these brave men and women who are serving our nation over there. So with that, I will conclude my comments and welcome any questions that you may have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, General Caldwell. Any questions or comments? Well, thank you, General Caldwell, for your service and for the service of the men and women.
I really appreciate you guys, this body, taking this on. So for me personally, my birthday comes up the same day as the state of Oregon's birthday in this organization. Coming up here on the 14th, it'll be my 39th year in this organization. So it's been a lot of fun. So,
thank you, General.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing. We will reopen that public hearing at 9 o'clock. So now we're going to go back to the beginning of the agenda, and I'm going to open a public hearing on the appointment of Greg Itow to the Board of Boiler Rules. And I probably mispronounced that, but you're not alone in me mispronouncing names, so.
It's actually Ito, like Judge Ito.
Okay.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair Devlin and members of the committee.
Just state your name for the record and
speak
for about 1 to 2 minutes about your interest in serving.
Sure, absolutely.
Your background.
The name's Greg Ito. I represent Garrett Callahan. I'm interested in joining the Board of Boiler Rules for the leadership and the public service opportunity. And I feel that I could be a contributor to the group because I do corrosion control of steam boilers as a water treatment professional, and I represent about 100 plus customers. I offer consultative services with respect to water treatment, and I can also do the same regarding legislation aspects of boilers as well to my customers. On the same token, I can also represent their inputs that they may have for the boiler committee as well.
Any questions for Mr. Ito? If not, thank you very much for coming here today. And our process is basically as we will go through all of these interviews, and then at the end we will take action on them. So,
okay,
thank
great.
You very much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Joseph Bowers. I will close that public hearing and opening a public hearing on the appointment of Jeffrey Pelson to the Oregon Board of Optometry. Mr. Pelson, are you here? And again, Mr. Pelson, just state your name for the record, and we will proceed from there.
Good morning, Chairman Devlin and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jeffrey Scott Pelson, and I am from Grants Pass, Oregon. Just representing the Oregon Board of Optometry and looking forward to just adding some personal flavor. Just always have had a desire to serve from being in the military to serving the public, and I'd like to continue that with the Board of Optometry.
Any questions, Mr. Pelson? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Close that public hearing. Open a public hearing for the appointment of Roger McKinney and Kent Williamson to the Oregon Medical Board. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Roger McKinney. I'm a urological surgeon from Eugene. Chair Devlin, and it's a pleasure to appear for you today in support of my nomination to the Oregon State Board of Medical Examiners. I am a native Oregonian. I was schooled in Oregon. My father was a professor of forest products at Oregon State University, and my medical education occurred both at OSU and at Oregon Health and Sciences University. So it was my pleasure to return to the state in 1994, where I practiced urology since that time, and I figure the state's about due for some return on some of its education that it's conferred on me. My feeling is that the integrity of the practice of medicine is best upheld in the spirit of volunteerism and hard work. And I will look forward to supporting safety of the patients of the state of Oregon and the highest standards of the medical profession.
Thank you.
And I'd be happy to entertain any questions that you have.
Ted, I'll go to the other one first.
Please do.
Yes. Please proceed. And then we'll go to questions. Doctor.
And Chairman Devlin, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Weldon Kent Williamson, a physician and surgeon in Portland, Oregon, in the practice of vascular surgery. I'd like to join the Oregon Medical Board to continue my strong interest in maintaining the highest quality of care for Oregonians and have been involved with those processes since 1993 in the form of multiple committee activities and now taking leadership within the Providence system with multiple hospitals to design morbidity and mortality conferences, quality review, peer review processes, and evaluating our systems of care to find opportunities to improve our quality, which I believe abound. And so I look forward to contributing back to the state level some effort to improve our quality of care and help my colleagues as physicians improve when necessary. I'd like to answer any questions.
Drs. McKinney and Williamson, I believe there will be a few questions. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I've had distributed to members of the Rules Committee and to the nominees before us a meeting notice from January 2010 of the Oregon Medical Board, and I'd like to call the committee's attention to the notification of the meeting for the regular quarterly meeting, which is in the center of the page. It indicates that there will be an executive session and further that there will be a public session. And there's an asterisk below the notification that says that this is a tentative agenda and is not inclusive of all the subjects to be discussed. Mr. Chairman, this is a notification that occupies about, I'd say, 4 inches of double-spaced, in some cases, type. It's for a two-day meeting. And it's certainly not indicative of what business was discussed at that meeting or the fact that there was major policy issues that were decided at that meeting. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask the nominees before us, looking at the notice before you and the fact that the agenda is supposed to cover a meeting lasting 2 days, do you consider this to be an adequate public notice for the complexity of the issues to be discussed? And, Mr. Chairman, what's driving this is information from interested parties who look at these agendas and have no idea what is going to be discussed at the meeting. The reason I bring this question before the nominees is they're going to be setting the policy and helping to direct the activities of this board. And I'd just like to hear them react to this two-day agenda, which covers about, well, who knows what it covers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Drs. McKinney and Williamson, I believe the director is here with you. So please proceed.
I'll make a comment to that question. We believe that a primary objective for the board is to have ultimate transparency in our decisions, policies, and we have been made aware that we can do better with regard to our public notification, and we have already addressed that directly and do plan to increase the availability of the information from these meetings and give more detail, basically, in public notices.
Chair Devlin, Senator Farioli, and the members of the board, I echo Dr. Williamson's feelings. I think that realize that we're just getting rolling and learning the craft, as it were. But I think that in the broad sense of carrying forward the mission of the Board of Medical Examiners, there has to be absolute transparency as to the procedures that we do, which includes ample meeting of meeting notices and the opportunity for interested parties to attend those proceedings.
Mr. Chairman, that is exactly the issue. I think these nominees have perceived it accurately. I urge them to set a very high bar in terms of transparency and inclusiveness. And I further would suggest that from the first minute of the first hour of the first day that you are fully fledged board members, and I anticipate your unanimous confirmation in this process, your vote counts as much as anybody else does. You know, so there's a tendency for us to want to do an apprenticeship, at least mentally, when we find ourselves in a new situation. And let me urge you not to do things the way they've always been done, but to insist on a high bar for inclusion and openness and transparency. And that's what I've heard here this morning, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any additional questions?
None for me.
Well, if not, I want to thank you both for coming and the director for coming. I hate to say this, but I actually have a specialist in each of your specialties, and also Dr. Pelson, who appeared earlier. So that's more a state to my health than my.
You don't need to voluntarily violate HIPAA for on your own.
But thank you very much for coming here this morning.
Sort of a personally driven economic development strategy, Senator.
Just don't go to morbidity conferences, okay?
Yes. Thank you very much for coming this morning. Oh, this one I don't use. I will close that public hearing and open a public hearing for the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery. Ms. Susan Hines and Ms. Cynthia Luxford. Ms. Hines, if you just state your name for the record and just give us 1 or 2 minutes about your interest in serving on the board.
Sure. My name is Susan Hines. I live in Corvallis, Oregon, and currently practice at Samaritan Hospital in Corvallis as a certified nurse midwife.
Okay.
Hi. thank you. I have to tell you, just first off, forgive me. I am a midwife and delivered 4 babies last night and have not slept in a very long period of time, so forgive me for that. I've been practicing midwifery in the state of Oregon for about 23 years.
Same mother, 4 different mothers.
I'm sorry?
You sparked a question. Senator Atkinson.
Were those 4 babies from the same mother or 4 different mothers?
4 different mothers, thank you. Yes.
Either way, that's a tough night of work.
Yes, 4 very wonderful different mothers. But I've had the pleasure of serving the state of Oregon for the last 23 years as a certified nurse midwife and have delivered well over 2,500 babies in the state. And as such, I currently deliver babies in the hospital, but I've also been involved in home birth. And so my interest in serving on this board stems from a very deep belief that I have that home birth really needs to remain an option in this state. But in doing so as a certified nurse midwife on the board, I believe my role has a lot to do with establishing standards and really looking at home birth events and peer review amongst midwives. And so that would be my goal, and my interest is maintaining a high standard because it is a very important issue for the health and well-being of the women of our state. Would you have any questions for me?
Any questions for Ms. Hines? Yes, Senator Ferriero.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oregon's just in the same situation that many states are with regard to our ability to keep OBGYN practice covered with medical malpractice insurance. And there was a point in time when there were so few hospitals willing to accept new patients for OBGYN and birthing services. I really think that the Oregon's midwives sort of really showed the value of the practice at that point in time, and it's something that I hope people understand and appreciate. So it's an incredibly valuable service, and I hope you will convey back to the your colleagues in practice that what they do is appreciated.
Thank you very much. Yes, we do, I believe, serve an incredible value in this state, and that's midwives of all degrees and all levels. As a certified nurse midwife, I work primarily in a hospital, but I think that midwifery care is important to all the women. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Two questions. Tell me about your doctorate.
I am currently working on my doctorate at OHSU, and it is a doctorate of nursing practice, and it's primarily about research in clinical applications. So what I'm looking at is what makes midwifery different. That is the focus of my practice and my doctorate, is what makes midwifery special, comparing to medicine, how we provide a different type of service. It's been a fascinating process, working full-time and taking call and doing what I do and working on a doctorate. It's been quite a process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any additional questions?
Just one, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
This is actually a question I would have expected from Senator Atkinson, but I'll ask it. When you finish your PhD, will you be doctor nurse?
Indeed. Doctor Midwife.
Doctor Midwife.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
TV series coming.
Doctor Midwife. A TV series, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My understanding is that Ms. Luxford is not here at this time.
Can we send her home?
Yeah, it's perfect. Perfect.
Well, I think that's
the crying, the meeting.
Oh, my God, it's juicy.
Yeah. I want in. Four babies in one night.
And it makes me tired even thinking. That'll close that public hearing, and we'll come back to Ms. Luxford if she's able to be here this morning. Okay. We are now opening a public hearing on the appointments of Robert Beisner to the State Workforce Investment Board. Mr. Beisner, if you'd please state your name for the record and just give us 1 to 2 minutes about your interest in serving on the board.
My name is Robert Beisner. Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My pleasure to appear before you this morning. My name is Robert Beisner. I'm on the board of directors of Solar World in Hillsboro, Oregon. I also serve as the vice president of legal human resources. As you know, the state of Oregon has made a considerable investment in renewable energy. These green jobs are very important to putting Oregonians back to work and creating a new workforce. We're very interested in seeing this get accomplished. I'm very interested in getting this done. I've supported both wind and solar energy companies in the past. I would hope that my experience in this regard would allow Oregon to move forward in this green job and renewable industries. Thank you, and I look forward to taking any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Meister?
Yes,
Senator Atkins. Oh, Senator Metzger.
Thank you for your willingness to serve. Solar World is you're a German company, correct?
Yes, we are.
And in your marketing, one of your major markets is, of course, trying to do this in the United States. I just find it interesting, and maybe you can explain just kind of the dynamics of this. First Solar is an American company whose major market right now is Germany, and based, you know, a few hundred miles to the south of us. And I don't know, you can explain that a little bit to me about that kind of interesting juxtaposition.
Sure. Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, it would be my pleasure to maybe share a few insights on the solar industry. We are a German company. Actually, our heritage here in the United States goes back to almost 30 years. We were originally Arco Solar, then we became Siemens Solar, then we became Shell Solar, and now Solar World. So we have a long history here in the United States, and it's just part of the global enterprise. First Solar is an interesting company. They're actually headquartered out of Ohio. They have a large production facility in Ohio. They also have a production facility in their headquarters in Arizona. They recently went into China in a big way because of some of the government incentives that were offered there. So it's just, I would just say, It's just the global competition. It's just the global incentives that exist in these renewable industries. And if I can go ahead and share with you some of the studies that have been done on the solar industry, I'd be happy to get those studies to you. Each one of these companies, for instance, with us, although most of our production is going to Europe right now, about 70% of what we do is exported to Europe. We're here in the United States, and we said when we came here to the United States in 2006, is because we viewed the United States as the largest solar market in the world. That's the potential that the United States have. We are spending about $500 million out in Hillsboro because we believe in the United States market. It's to build modules and cells here in the United States, have them put to work here in the United States. We'd like to get out of the export business, but that's where the market is right now, and that's where we'll be.
Mr. Chair, could I stray just one more question?
Yes, yes. Please.
Just because of your expertise, and this is the investment board, so I'm kind of stretching a little bit, but as you know, this legislature is struggling with what the business energy tax credit and what is appropriate. And I know I've been reading a lot in the Wall Street about your industry and Germany because of their very lucrative feed-in tariffs and that they're wheeling those back, and you've seen some of the impacts of some of that decision-making because they're very concerned now that it's kind of getting out of control in terms of their budgeting. Could you just briefly, and I don't want to take a lot of the time, but your expertise is valuable in this, is what role do you feel and to what extent is that necessary for your industry in terms of what Oregon is currently doing and how we're looking in the next few days of revising that program?
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, Senator Metzger, I'm very happy to speak to the issues of the business energy tax credits. In fact, I presented some testimony yesterday, and I'll also be happy to state the way in which our company views these types of incentives, including the feed-in tariff in Germany. What we're looking for is we're looking for grid parity. What you want us to do is be able to be cost-effective so that that way, whether you would buy your electricity from your utility or pull it down off your roof, that it would cost about the same. And that's very important. Because of the type of incentives, such as the business energy tax credits, you're able to help us scale up and get to an economic level where we, in fact, are competitive with the rates that are charged by any utility in the world. That's what's made the program very successful in Germany, is that this was a subsidy that was given. It's been coming down over the years. We know it has to come down. We want it to come down because we need to stand on our own and be economically viable. And what we need is just a little help for a short period of time to get us to grid parity. That's the intent of the business energy tax credits. I applaud the state of Oregon for what they've done. They've separated the more mature industries from the more developing industries. And so the way in which you've been able to balance this, I really applaud the way that the legislature has worked with the governor's office to come up with this solution. We think this is a good solution.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for letting me ask it.
Okay. Senator Atkinson.
No question.
Thank you very much for
coming here this morning.
And we'll take action on your appointment just a little bit later. I'm now going to close that public hearing, reopen a public hearing on the appointment of Cynthia Luxford to the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery. Ms. Luxford. And Ms. Luxford, if you would please state your name for the record, and hope you have not had as long a night as Ms. Hines, who delivered four babies last night.
No, I did not have that long of a night last night. My name is Cynthia Luxford, and I live in Otis, Oregon. And I'd like to just say hello to Chair Devlin and members of the committee. And I did not have that long of a night.
And just a little bit about your interest in serving on the board.
I've been a licensed midwife in Oregon for nearly 17 years, and I have just been very impressed with the decisions that have been made during my time. I've been to several board meetings and seen how the board has worked, and it's just been kind of inspiring to me that I could be able to be part of that decision-making process for the midwives and the citizens of Oregon. I've enjoyed seeing that the women and families' rights have been definitely thought of and cared about in keeping midwifery alive in Oregon and keeping the license going. And so I just was really very excited to be able to help in that way. So Yeah. There's a lot of things that right now are important to some decisions that to be made in the board, and so I've been a little, you know, privy to that, and I do expect to learn a lot while I'm on the board too, but then to also at the same time be able to lend my experience and my knowledge to that effort.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much for appearing
You're
here
welcome.
This morning, and we'll take action on your appointment just a little bit later.
Okay, thank you.
His vote is still for sale.
Thank you. I will close that public hearing, open a public hearing on the appointments of Nancy Watt to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Good morning, Ms. Watt.
Good morning, Senator Devlin and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Watt. I am a lifelong Oregon educator. I went to Oregon schools. I graduated from Oregon colleges. In the course of my career, I've been an English teacher, a librarian, a vice principal, a principal, and the last 16 years of my career I spent at Pacific University, where I eventually was dean in the College of Education. I retired 2 years ago. And I think most retirees, there's sort of the initial bloom of all of this time. And then you sort of get to the point where you realize that you have a body of knowledge that you're not using. I've looked at a variety of volunteer things, and this is the one that seems to fit my interest, my experience, and I can think of nothing more important to me than making sure that the children of Oregon schools have the best possible teacher. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Watt?
I have a question.
Yes. So Senator Atkinson.
Thank you, Ms. Watt. You are serving as a public member.
I am.
Seems like you are an overqualified public member.
I guess I never thought of it in that respect. I simply have an interest in doing it and a body of knowledge that I think would be useful to the commission. I understand your point. But I guess what I would want to say in this capacity, I would not be representing higher ed. I would not be representing teachers. I would not be representing administrators. I would be representing the students in Oregon schools.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Senator Ferriero.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to disappoint every single appointee that's come before the Rules Committee during my tenure for the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Has been asked to consider possibly repurposing the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. It doesn't really do anything, Mr. Chairman, to guarantee that teachers who are in class are competent. It does check their credentials. It checks their educational background. It makes sure that they are certifiable in Oregon, meeting the criterion to be a teacher. It deals with complaints and adjudicates issues of fitness that are complaint-driven. But it really doesn't do anything to certify or to guarantee that the teachers that are currently teaching are competent to teach the subjects to which they've been assigned. So it seems like the Standards and Practices Commission may be misnamed, or maybe people have a different understanding of what it ought to be doing or what it does do.
Are you suggesting it should be just the Standards Commission?
No, Mr. Chairman, what I'm suggesting is that it actually undertake the issue of whether or not teachers in classrooms, are highly qualified to teach in the subjects to which they've been assigned.
Do you care to respond, Ms.
Do I care to?
Yes.
I would be happy to. I think in one sense they do deal with competency initially when they're licensed. They deal with competency again when license is renewed. I'm wondering what you might envision what that would look like in terms of dealing with the competency, the commission dealing with the competency once they're already they're in the classroom. Do you have a sense of that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes, and I don't want to engage in a colloquy here, but I'll just use my personal experience, and I think it may be common experience to everyone who goes through a public school system. We all have teachers who are eminently qualified on paper who are lousy teachers. We've experienced people that have achieved educational attainment and longevity in the system, but they don't inspire and they don't leave students with a thirst for learning. And it's just my impression that there's nobody looking at those things.
I wouldn't argue with your conclusion, having spent most of my life in and around schools. However, how many? There's something like 60,000 licensed teachers in Oregon, somewhere upwards of 25,000 currently teaching in public schools. Traditionally, that evaluation process has been the function of the school district and typically of the administrators in the schools themselves. Having done that kind of work myself, I think there are some other issues involved, one of which is simply the amount of time that it takes in order to properly evaluate a teacher, which school administrators frequently don't have that much time, at least the way schools are organized currently, they don't. The other part is that when you find that teacher who doesn't inspire, my husband sometimes is wont to say that we take five-year-olds and stomp the curiosity right out of them. I don't believe that's true all the time, but it certainly does happen. Is once you find that teacher, and I can assure you that every administrator in Oregon can identify those teachers, it's very, very, very difficult to move that teacher to a place where they might be more successful. And I think that takes more than just the commission to deal with.
Mr. Chairman, I've heard perception and wisdom here this morning, and also a quote that I will to share with the whomever happens to be watching this hearing on the internet or here in the building. The applicant, the nominee, indicated that she had a body of knowledge that she wasn't using. And I would submit that we really need to have that body of knowledge put to work at this Teachers and Standard Practice Commission. But you've come to a building where there is a huge body of knowledge that we're not using. And it's sort of a feature of the legislature. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for indulging my questions.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Any additional questions? If not, thank you very much for coming here this morning.
Thank
you for your willingness to continue to serve. I will close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Jill Eland to the State Board of Higher Education.
Yeah, she's pretty sure.
Ms. Eland.
Good morning. It's Eland.
Eland. Please state your name for the record.
I'm Jill Eland, 9536 Northwest Arborview Drive in Portland, and I work for Intel Corporation. And I'm a candidate for the Higher Ed Board.
Okay. Just talk for a minute or two about your interest and your background.
I'm a graduate of the Oregon University System, and I'm currently a tuition-paying parent at Oregon State University. And so this opportunity to serve the state matches both my personal and professional interests. Intel's philanthropic focus is all around improving higher education. So I'm excited to join the group.
Okay. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. What needs to be improved in higher ed?
I believe that the funding needs to be improved in higher ed. There needs to be more investment in higher education in Oregon. I appreciate we're in an economic crisis, but I'd like to see all Oregonians make higher education a higher priority.
What stops us from funding higher education?
Some of it is the limitations in the funding. I think the rest of it is the priority setting of the legislature and the fact that you don't hear from enough of your constituents and business leaders that higher education investments are important.
What's your view of research? This body took a very big push at investing into higher education research, and then about 5 years ago, two sessions ago, the effort fell flat. The business community that was involved, especially out of your day job,
just went away, and there was no more support for research. Do you have any opinion about that?
I don't know the particulars about that, Senator Atkinson. I would tell you that are you referring to ETIC and those kinds of organizations, or are you referring to specifically the Research Committee of the Higher Ed Board?
I'm talking about the push that we made from Oregon Health Science University to have the tools to invest into research and to connect Oregon Health Sciences with OSU and U of O and create a research corridor similar to what happened in the state of Maryland. And it was a big push. We had a lot of folks out of high tech and out of Intel that were pushing for it, and then poof, it all went away. It became a partisan issue, and people who were involved in that push, myself included, found we looked behind us and there was nobody behind us anymore. And all of a sudden the effort slowed down and kind of died.
Well, I wasn't part of that history, but I'll certainly do some homework and get a better answer for
you.
Well,
I didn't say you were. I was saying, what's your opinion?
Oh, excuse me. What's my opinion? Well, obviously, Intel invests a lot in research, and we have several partnerships within the Oregon University system for some of that. Most of it, I would tell you, is outside of Oregon with Tier 1 universities, so-called Tier 1 universities. But I believe strongly that providing opportunities for investments in research and collaboration and getting that coalition to come back together to review the advantages that a strong commitment to research would provide the state would be a good thing.
Thank you. A few more follow-ups.
Yes,
Chair Devlin. This body, very in a partisan meltdown, passed a stimulus package about a year ago this month, actually. And a couple of universities received a big chunk of money out of that. And now if you drive all over rural Oregon, you see billboards from Western Oregon University that are promoting services at Western Oregon University. I actually think that while I don't like how the funding works for them to put up billboards, I do like the fact that they're advertising. Do you think that the regional universities are adequately marketed? Do you think they could do a better job? Or what's your opinion of the brand that our universities have, or especially our regional universities have in Oregon?
I know that many of the best and brightest students in Oregon choose to go elsewhere, so I would imagine that the Oregon University system as a whole could do a little bit better job of marketing. I think there's a great product coming out of the Oregon University system, so I'd like to see there be more partnership across the system to the high schools and to the high-performing students to get them to stay in Oregon.
Thank you. Do you have an opinion of the entrepreneurial model that we used to keep tuition dollars in colleges rather than go to the Department of the Higher, the Chancellor's Office to go through a formula in the back up? Years ago, we passed an entrepreneurial model that kept tuition dollars in the university where the tuition dollars were spent. Previously, dollars would go essentially to Salem. They would go through a formula, much like the K-12 fiasco, and then they would be doled out to universities. And those regional schools never seem to do as well as some of our bigger marquee schools. In your opinion, has that been working, not working?
Again, I haven't gotten in and actually seen the budget allocations for higher education, but I would tell you that the push for flexibility that many of the university presidents are currently advocating for, I think, is a good idea. And so I would imagine that I could support that entrepreneurial approach.
Two more questions?
Yes.
There occasionally is talk of us moving Oregon's higher education system to more of a California model, in which you have a university, or for our state, you would have an Oregon State with various campuses, a University of Oregon with various campuses, and essentially taking the regionals, Western, Southern, Eastern, and making them into a unified university system. So, for instance, the Southern Oregon University would become the University of Oregon at Ashland, and Eastern Oregon University perhaps would become Oregon State University at La Grande. Do you have an opinion on that modeling?
I'm sure that the legislators who represent those universities outside of the Big Three would be concerned about that, and I'd certainly want to understand what those concerns were. But I think anything that reduces the administrative cost of providing a quality education to Oregonians would be worth looking at.
Thank you. I'll just make a comment, not a last question. You're doing great, and I'm sorry to ask you questions. You're doing fine. I think that, in my opinion, of one of 30, higher education as an issue is stalled in the Senate, and it's stalled behind K-12 funding, just to be blunt. Higher education should be our biggest priority, and I agree with you 100% that the most valuable export that we have in Oregon is high school seniors who go to California or to the University of Idaho because it's cheaper and they have a better perception. I do not believe that we invest at all into research, and I think that's a huge mistake. That the legislature largely looks ahead 2 years, not 10 years ahead. And the University of Maryland system, and I believe it was North Carolina's investment into research, is now driving their entire economy, and we've missed that boat. Lastly, I will tell you that I don't believe we've done a very good job at all of marketing our university system. When we moved from the college system to the university system, we had a huge opportunity for Southern, OIT, Eastern, even Western to go into some much significantly better marketing. And they fell into the trap of, well, we don't have enough funding, so we're going to specialize. And we became, our regional universities, instead of becoming universities, became micro-niched into nursing and teachers' colleges rather than into a comprehensive university system. So I think we need to do a better job. And my last charge to you, as I support you wholeheartedly, is this. Oregon Health Science University is probably the greatest asset that we have, and it is easily the most underutilized university that we have on the West Coast, meaning the partnerships that we should be having, we don't have. The research that we should be investing in is political. And they need to have a better reputation connecting of that system, that body, as a medical school being something the entire state pulls upon. And you're not the first person I've said this to, but since you're going to be in that position, please don't forget Oregon Health Science University is a major magnet for the leadership that you're about to join to focus on, because I think it is, and I think it's underutilized.
I agree, and I look forward to your leadership on that issue.
Any additional? If not, thank you very much for appearing here this morning. I will close that public hearing, and I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Barney Spate to the Public Employees Benefit Board.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I've heard him described in that way.
Well, it's not meant in spite.
Good morning.
You've probably heard that before.
Chair Devlin, Vice Chair Ferrioli, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barney Spate. I have responded to other names similar to that. I am grateful for the governor's nomination of me to the Public Employees Benefit Board. I think the work that I am now doing with the Oregon Health Authority as a deputy director and working and implementing some of the reforms of 2009 gives me a perspective that I can bring to the board. I would note historically, in one of my previous lives, I was a member of the Public Employees Oregon Public Employees Benefit Board in the Kitzhaber administration, and for a couple of years was the administrator of the Washington Public Employees Benefit Board when I was the deputy director of the Healthcare Authority in the state of Washington. That, along with about 32 years of experience in various roles in both policy and administration and healthcare, I hope that I can join the colleagues of the Public Employees Benefit Board and help the board get its work done well.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming here this morning.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. And I will close public hearing, opening a public hearing on the appointment of Mary Lou Heinrich to the Oregon Educators Benefit Board.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, Vice Chair Ferrioli. I'm Mary Lou Heinrich, and I am
very honored to be here this morning talking to you and telling you that I would be very pleased to serve on a relatively new Oregon Educators Benefit Board. My past experience has ranged from being starting out as a field public health nurse in Multnomah County, and being an administrator and deputy director, the first director of CARE Oregon that we formed with a collaboration with OHSU and Multnomah County and Community Migrant Health Centers for Medicaid Managed Care. It's now the largest Medicaid Managed Care provider in Oregon. And I am now the executive director of a nonprofit public health organization called Community Health Partnership, Oregon's Public Health Institute. And we're trying to look at how to prevent things so that the healthcare system doesn't have to go broke trying to fix people that are broken. So we worked on things like the school nutrition standards, PE in schools, other kinds of preventive aspects related to health. And so I was asked to consider serving on OEB and bring my prevention hat and my experience with insurance and with benefits and how they're put together and how you hopefully can do some more innovative things that the board would like to do. So I said, all right, I'll step forward if asked.
Any questions? If not, thank you very much for coming here today and thank you for your willingness to serve.
Thank you.
I will close that public hearing, opening a public hearing on the appointments of Joseph Bowers and Dan Carlson to the Building Code Structures Board. And if you'd both come forward, start in whichever order you would prefer to start in. Just state your name for the record, and just give us 1 to 2 minutes on your interest in serving.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Devlin, Vice Chair Farrielli. For the record, my name is Joseph Bowers. I'm Vice President and Business Representative for Ironworkers in State of Oregon and Southwest Washington. And I'm here for the Building Code Structures Board. We feel that that's kind of what the Ironworkers do. We build structures, bridges, buildings, and feel that we could have a good input on that board.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Dan Carlson. It's an honor to speak with you today. I'm here representing myself, the City of Corvallis, and the Oregon Building Officials Association. I presently work for the City of Corvallis. I would briefly like to highlight for you why I'm interested in this position. On a professional level, I have a background in both construction and building custom homes, and spending the last 14 years working as an administrator of the building codes in inspections and plan review and a building official. I currently also volunteer my time to serve on the Oregon Building Officials Association Board of Directors. And from a professional codes perspective, I'm multi-certified by the State of Oregon and the International Code Council. I hold certifications across a number of disciplines, and because of my Oregon roots, I also have a professional interest in sustainable construction practices and green materials and the use of green materials. I'm familiar with alternative construction methods and the approval of those methods, the nature of working as a building official in a mid-sized university town provides a lot of opportunity to look at a variety of structures, a variety of different construction methods, and applying our building codes, our very complicated building codes, to those structures in a way that makes some sense, hopefully is practical, and I look forward to collaborating on this with this board and over broader code-related issues across the state and in a way that enhances the public safety and energy efficiency and the future livability of our state in the building environment. So if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to take those.
Okay. Any questions? Yeah, Senator Farrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have absolutely no question that these two gentlemen are eminently qualified to help Oregon add value through the administration of our building code system. This is one of those areas where there's a tremendous intersection between public policy and politics. And, you know, what we're seeing right now is the utilization of public policy or even the utilization of politics to drive public policy perhaps toward definitions of sustainability that aren't science-based. Maybe somebody has a notion that we can do some social engineering and achieve a better livability by utilizing the building codes sort of to drive people in one direction or another. And I was just wondering, because that's true, it's possible that you could be subjected to a tremendous amount of political pressure to do something that perhaps you don't believe is science-based. But because you serve at the pleasure of the governor, it may be put to you in such a way that if you don't support a particular direction in public policy, your services would no longer be necessary. How will you resist that kind of pressure? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please proceed.
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, I'm sorry, Farioli.
I'm not offended by
In response to your question, it's a very good question, and certainly as a building official in a mid-sized university town, we see a lot of various proposals that come our way for alternate methods, materials of construction. Somebody that is working out of their garage, for example, has a great idea and wants to, say, build a house out of cob or a house out of straw bales or rubber tires. Or, you know, we've had examples of folks who are mixing biodiesel in their garages and things like that, all of which have merit and all of which need to perhaps be looked at closely based on the scientific merits of their proposal. And there is a lot of pressure at times as a building official, whether it be from the mayor or whether it be from the city manager. And the way that I deal with that is I maintain my integrity. I keep my character intact. It's the same thing that I stress with a group of Boy Scouts that I work with. And I think if you follow that internal compass, you're going to be okay. And if that goes against the governor's wishes, then I'm sorry. But that's just the way that I would perceive it, and I would make that judgment based on that.
Would you care to respond?
Chair Devlin, Vice Chair Farioli. On that also, you know, what we do, we don't like to cut corners. If it's something that's not right, you know, we don't encourage anybody, any of our people to do that, because these are the roads we drive on, the buildings we go in. So, you know, if it's something that if it's against the governor's wishes or whatnot, you know, I stand for what's right. And that's, you know, we want to do what's right and make these things, buildings and roads, as safely as we can. So that's where I stand, but do the right thing.
Mr. Chairman, in reaction to the comments that I've heard here, public safety first. You know, and policy, if it's science-based, you know, and it's demonstrable, but political agendas, not so much. I have faith that if you've been a building inspector, that you've already encountered this kind of pressure, and anybody that's watched an iron worker strap on a 60-pound tool belt and go straight up a girder without a ladder, you know, just on physical strength, knows that they have the strength to resist undue influence. Mr. Chairman, every single person who's appeared before this committee over the last couple of days has gotten a copy of the article that appeared in the Oregonian regarding the issue over the removal or resignation of the director of the Marine Board. So I just, you know, I think it's part of our business to make sure people understand there's a difference between serving at the pleasure of the governor or doing the governor's bidding. And I think these gentlemen understand that. Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you both for coming here this morning, and we'll take action on your appointment just a little bit later this morning.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I'll close that public hearing, opening a public hearing on the appointment of Stephen Pixley to the Oregon Volunteer Commission for Voluntary Action and Service. Mr. Pixley, if you would just state your name for the record and give us 1 to 2 minutes on your background.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman, Senators. I'm Stephen Pixley from Portland, Oregon. For the past 14 years, I've had the pleasure of having about the best job in the city of Portland. I'm the Volunteer Program Coordinator. I've been involved with the Northwest Oregon Volunteer Administrators Association for that long, continuing education in how to become a better volunteer manager. I've completed some national courses in Certificate of Volunteer Administration, and I am very anxious to take some of the experiences I had and bring it to this commission to try and share some of my thoughts and my opinions and my direct experiences in dealing with more traditional volunteers, the parents and grandparents and students who want to get involved with their community and give a little bit back to their community.
Any questions? Thank you very much for here this morning, and we'll take action on your appointment a little bit later. Close that public hearing. And which one? Okay. And I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Deborah Ormond McHugh to the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board. Please state your name for the record and then just give us 1 to 2 minutes on your background.
Sure. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Ormond McHugh, and I am nominated for a position on the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board. I was asked by NAMI Oregon, the Oregon State chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, to represent the voices of consumers, patients, people who have mental illness, as well as their families and friends who care about them. So that will be my, that would be my position on the board, is to represent those voices and bring that perspective to the table. My interest in serving this position, I've been involved with NAMI in Oregon and California for the last 15 years, served as the local chapter president, and something that I believe in and would like to represent them.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Farioli.
I hope you got a briefing on the situation that Oregon finds itself in with regard to operation of the Oregon State Mental Hospital.
Yeah. I haven't had a briefing, but I'm aware of it just as an interested person.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, we're not far away from having the federal government operate the Oregon State Hospital.
And we all know the federal government operates things very well. That's not meant to be sarcastic.
they do. They operate things until there's almost nobody left to operate on. But the fact remains that it's a very serious challenge you're about to undertake, and we're under court order. There's some other really serious issues about patient care, particularly individualized diagnoses and individualized treatment modalities that are prescribed for the individual rather than just sort of batched. In other words, if you read the record of what we have discovered about the operations of the Oregon State Mental Hospital, it's very instructive. And if you also read the court order, that's pretty clear. So I hope you understand that you're undertaking a very important challenge, and we hope to bring all your expertise and ability and energy to the problem we don't have a choice about solving.
True.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your willingness to serve and for coming here this morning. I'm closing that public hearing and opening a public hearing on the appointment of Olivia Williams to the State Board of Tax Practitioners. Ms. Williams, just state your name for the record.
Good morning, Chairman Devlin and members of the committee. My name is Olivia Williams, but I do go by D. So, and I'm honored to be appointed to serve on the State Board of Tax Practitioners by Governor Kulongoski. And you want me to just give you why I...
I'll
just jump right into it then. I'm a licensed tax consultant in Oregon, and I am enrolled to practice before IRS federally. I've owned and operated my tax bookkeeping and payroll practice, which is Williams, Williams & Company, in the Salem area since 1986. I have earned my business, my Bachelor of Science in Business, actually at, was known WASC at the time that I was going to at Western Oregon State College, but which is Western Oregon University now. And I have a Master's of Taxation from Washington School of Law in Provo, Utah. The Board of Tax Practitioner was about 7 to 8 years old when I first joined the tax professional industry, and I believe that the oversight, regulation, and education provided by the board enhanced my professionalism and my ability to serve, educate, and assist any client, my clientele for the last 25 years. I have recently merged my tax practice with Van Loo PC here in Salem, and I feel now it's time for me to be able to give back to the community that has supported my business through the years. The tax law on both the federal and state level is very challenging at this time, and I believe that the Oregon Board of Tax Practitioner has in the past and continues today to protect Oregon consumers and to enrich the practitioner community by ensuring that professionals maintain a high level of competency and ethical standards. The Oregon Board of Tax Practitioner is the national role model for what's going on nationally in Washington with the tax preparer program that's going on. And I believe that our model is going to serve the nation, you know, as well. So this is both a federal and a state issue that's being done. So I am honored to be nominated to serve on the State Board of Tax Practitioners and look forward to having the opportunity to give my experience and knowledge to meet the board's missions. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I would be happy to answer any questions that I may be able to do for you.
Questions?
Senator Ferriola. I do have a question, Mr. Chairman. Can you state the highest nominal rate of taxation for personal income? What's the top bracket? In Oregon.
The top bracket in Oregon.
Yes,
it's just changed.
So,
9.75 at this point.
And I believe it goes all the way to 11.
Yeah, it can go to 11 depending upon your tax situation, as I tell my clients sometimes.
Gross income.
You have to look at the individual
right.
situation to know which that is going to be.
And, Mr. Chairman, I assure you this is not the case, but if my nominal income tax rate was 11%, what would my capital gains tax rate be?
Your capital gains tax is, at this point was 20%. That's going to be your highest, that 20%, right, under present law. You know, so it would be around 20%.
Yes, and I was actually just referring to the state capital gains tax.
The state capital gains tax.
be the same.
I don't know.
Actually, I think the chairman answered my question. No. Mr. Chairman, could you make that answer a little louder?
Please.
It would be the same.
Be the same.
So what I'm suggesting is that because the highest nominal income tax rate is 11%, the highest capital gains tax rate is 11%.
Yes.
I think it's amazing how many Oregonians believe there's a separate statute that governs capital gains tax. There is no separate statute that governs the rate of capital gains. It's your personal income tax rate.
Yes.
So one of the effects of Measure 66 and 67 was to raise the capital gains tax at the highest nominal rate to 11%.
Okay.
And I hope people are aware of that fact. If they're not, they're certainly going to be told that by their tax accountants in due course between now and April 15th.
Yes.
Some Oregonians are going to get the surprise of a lifetime.
I'm sure on both the federal and the state level that there are going to be some surprises, yes.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, I guess this is one incidence only that people might be grateful that they don't have a lot of capital gains.
That's true.
One more question, Mr.
Yes.
Chairman. Oregon has disconnected its tax code from the federal code. Does that complicate your life as a tax preparer?
Anytime there's a disconnect, there are challenges. Yes. And because we have to go back and make sure that we are matching things up and getting things taken to the proper places, you know, for the clientele.
And, Mr. Yeah. Chairman, the disconnect was designed to deny
yeah.
Certain deductions to the Oregon population that exist in the federal codes.
That's true. There are sometimes some disconnects that cause surprises, as you mentioned before.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. I might disagree with the word deny, because basically the effect of the one disconnect was to deny the accelerated depreciation. Parties are still can still depreciate, but at the normal schedule.
I guess it's a matter of spin control, Mr. Chairman.
It's a matter of semantics.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
I like this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes our public hearings on appointments this morning. What I'm going to do very quickly here, for those parties that are still waiting for us to take action, I'm going to do one bill that's going to take us about 5 minutes, and then we're going to come back and do all the motions for everyone that we have heard from this morning. So I am going to open a public hearing on SR3, and Senator Schrader, if you would please come forward. General Caldwell appeared this morning at about 8:05 and did a very good job. And if you would please just state your name for the record and proceed at your leisure.
Okay. Good morning, colleagues. I am Oregon State Senator Martha Schrader, Senate District 20, and I am here this morning to support General Caldwell. I believe that he had to catch an early flight this morning, and I think this resolution is self-explanatory. As you know, in May of 2010, we are expecting the 41st Brigade to return from their duties in Iraq, as well as other duties in Afghanistan, and I do believe, since this body has passed the largest number of bills, I believe, in a decade dealing with our military and their families, that this is a resolution that will embody the fact that Oregon is the welcome home state for our military folks. It is largely, I believe, symbolic. So when these folks come back and have been in war zones, and many of them will suffer, I think, some trauma from being in these war zones, that the state of Oregon will be there and will be present for them and with them to acknowledge their sacrifices, to acknowledge the fact that they are coming back to their families, and that we will be there to make sure that the needs of the veterans as well as the needs of the family are met. So I think it's a very, very straightforward resolution. I fully expect it to be supported by everyone across the aisle. And I am looking forward to making sure that May 8th of this year, 2010, is actually going to be dedicated to the 41st Brigade Combat Team as it returns. I think it's very, very important that we send this symbolic message, and am very grateful that I have had an opportunity to work with the Guard, our military families, and continue to work on substantive policy bills that will continue to help our military folks when they return back to Oregon. So thank you for this opportunity.
Any questions for Senator Schrader? That looks like an aye.
That is a question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Schrader, you had to pre-session file this bill.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if the good senator would have any objection to having every member of the Senate join her in sponsorship on this.
I would absolutely welcome every member of the Senate joining the sponsorship, and let's get that on record and let's move that forward, and I will get my staff person on it very quickly, so with whatever we need to do to make that happen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the chief sponsorship of the bill, certainly that honor should go to Senator Schrader, but the because we had to pre-session file these bills,
yes.
There wasn't an opportunity for other members to be offered an opportunity.
Right.
And I agree with the senator. I can't imagine any member not wanting to participate in the Making Oregon the Welcome Home State for
mm-hmm.
Veterans.
Absolutely. And I will add that we are getting some national attention because we have done such a, the Guard in particular, working with the Army Reserve and the other branches of the military, has really set some national models for reintegration practices. And right now we do have a reintegration team that is actually continuing to look at best practices. So when they come back, it will inform the Guard's yellow ribbon program for these families. Our Guard has really done a phenomenal job, and they are getting kudos not only from the Guard, within the Guard themselves, but the other branches of the military are recognizing their commitment to this. And as you know, sometimes that's a little unusual because, you know, branches of the military kind of, you know, whether you're Army, Navy, whatever, this is actually bringing the branches of the military together in a common goal, which has been quite remarkable as well. So,
Mr. Chairman,
okay.
I would suggest that as caucus leader, you could circulate the appropriate document within your caucus, and I would volunteer to do the same thing so that these could all arrive at the same moment at the president's desk.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything additional? Seeing none, thank you very much for appearing here this morning, Senator.
Thank you for this opportunity.
I will close the public hearing. I will open a work session on SR3. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, it would be my honor to move SR3 to the floor with a do pass or a be adopted recommendation.
Okay. Senator Farioli has moved SR3 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion?
And Mr. Chairman, the with the assumption that every member will be offered an opportunity to sponsor.
We'll try to coordinate with Senator Schrader's office and just, and we can both do a sheet in our respective caucuses.
Perfect, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Any objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, motion passes. Senator Schrader will carry. Now I will go through my long. No request to divide any of these motions from anyone. Okay. Close that work session. Opening a work session and moving the following appointments to the following boards and commissions to the Senate floor with the AB confirmed en bloc recommendation. Greg Itow to the Board of Boiler Rules, Joseph Bowers and Dan Carlson to the Building Code Structures Board, Mary Lou Henrick to the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, Jill Island to the State Board of Higher Education, Robert McKimmy and Kent Williamson to the Oregon Medical Board, Susan Hines and Cynthia Luxford to the State Board of Direct Entry Midwifery, Jeffrey Pelson to the Oregon Board of Optometry, Deborah Orman McHugh to the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board, Barney Spate to the Public Employees Benefit Board, Nancy Watt to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, Olivia Williams to the State Board of Tax Practitioners, Stephen Pixley to the Oregon Volunteer Commission for Voluntary Action and Service, Robert Beisner to the State Workforce Investment Board. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. I'm opening a work session and moving the reappointments to the following boards and commissions to the Senate floor with a be confirmed en bloc recommendation. Mary Lou Henrick to the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, Barney Spate to the Public Employees Benefit Board, Donald Garand and Louise Neese to the Oregon Medical Board. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Farioli, would you carry the first motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, happy to do it.
And Senator Metzger, would you carry the second? And if you happen to be on the dais at the time, I will fill in for you on the floor. Okay, that concludes that. Now I'm going to do a little unusual. I'm going to take about a 3-minute recess for the committee, and we will restart about 9:25.
19. Could the committee administrator please give an overview of the amendment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1014 was originally heard in a public hearing on February 2nd, at which time we had several amendments proposed. What 1014, as written, is allow a state board or commission to meet by telephone or other electronic means and clarifies that members who participate by phone or other electronic means are not entitled to compensation or reimbursement. It modifies terms of office and compensation and reimbursement for expenses for members, and it removes the President and Senate and Speaker of the House of Representatives from Fujian Sister State Committee. What we have before you are the Dash 11 amendments, and you also have a hand and gross version with the Dash 11 amendments. What those amendments are a compilation of the previously proposed amendments. So what they do is it allows a state board or commission to have the discretion to reimburse member or members who participate by telephone, deletes the changes to the terms of service for the Oregon Health Policy Board, Health Information Technology Oversight Council, and Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board. It deletes the changes to the Fujian Sister State Committee, clarifies reimbursement and compensation for members of the Legislative Assembly who serve on specific boards and commissions. It increases the State Board of Pharmacy to 8 members, and it repeals the Pacific Fisheries Legislative Task Force, Columbia River Task Force, and Healthy Streams Partnership. We have a no revenue impact on the Dash 11 and a minimal fiscal impact on the Dash 11.
Okay. Do we have a, since we're in work session, do we have a motion on the Dash 11?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I have some questions.
Yes.
Can I have at least some bracket around why we're modifying the terms of office for several of the boards and commissions?
I will bring forward the expert on commissions. Yes.
Chair Devlin, Senator Farioli. Actually, the original bill had some changes to the terms of office. In the amendments, those have been removed. So
okay.
There are no changes of office except for moving a beginning date for one term of office from July 1st to July 2nd, so the two terms do not overlap.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That answers my question. The other question I have is, are we doing away with the Fisheries Commissions and the Healthy Stream Partnership?
Chair Devlin, Senator Farioli, yes, all three of those are what is considered inactive task forces. One of them was the funding was cut several years ago, and it's just continued to be in statute. One finished its work, and the other one was combined into another task force to make a new, the Healthy Streams Partnership was made into a new organization, so it is also at this point inactive.
And, Mr. Chairman, what new organization was that?
Chair Devlin, Senator Farioli, I don't have that in front of me, but I can get it for you. It was in the Kitzhaber administration.
Right. I think you cited it the last time.
The
previous or
the future?
You were
the ones in future.
Mr. Chairman, you've answered my questions. I thank you very much.
Okay.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Does the Dash 11s still get rid of the participation on the Fujian sister state? I heard you mention that in the...
It does.
Okay. Oh,
it maintains the President and the Speaker of the House as co-chairs.
Yeah.
The original measure would have removed them as the automatic co-chairs and allow them to designate who they would like as their co-chairs of the committee.
So what does this do?
It doesn't. It just repeals that change. It doesn't make any actual changes to the Fujian sister state.
So they're
committee.
Still on it?
They're still on it.
Chair Devlin, Senator Atkinson, yes, in the Dash 11s, there is no change to the Fujian Sister State Commission.
Okay. Even though I'm outnumbered in the overall policy, I'm glad to see that change. Thank you.
Okay. We have a motion before us to adopt the Dash 11 amendments. Any objections to the Dash 11 amendments? Seeing none, that motion passes. Do we have another amendment?
No, that's it.
Okay. Do we have a main motion as the bill is amended?
Sure. I move Senate Bill 1014 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Metzger has moved SB 1014 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections?
No, no, no.
You only get one.
Count that as a 3-1 vote in the committee. And Senator Burdick is excused. Motion passes. We will actually assign the bill to Senator Courtney unless he chooses not to carry it.
Thank you, Senator Devlin.
With that, I will open a public hearing
on SJR 41.
On SJR 41. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Do you want me to go through the amendments or just the bill?
Basically, we've gone through the bill. Probably go through the amendments.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SDR 41 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to require annual sessions of the Legislative Assembly. We have before you the -2, -4, and -5 amendments. The -2 amendment sets a legislative session an odd-numbered year to not exceed 135 calendar days, an even-numbered year not to exceed 45 days. The -4 amendments would refer the measure to the November 2010 general election, and the -5 amendments would permit Legislative Assembly to hold a pre-session organizational session not subject to the limits in the number of calendar days permitted for a legislative session and prohibits action on gubernatorial vetoes during that pre-session organizational.
Question, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
What items may be undertaken during the pre-session organizational?
My understanding that the only items that can be undertaken would be the organization, election of officers, which is the organization. Committees could be appointed. And beyond that, there is probably an outstanding issue that would be subject probably to rule of whether bills could actually be first read.
So this would be a bill introduction?
It could be. But it would not be a, how would I say it? There would be...
It wouldn't count.
No. There would be no action on bills until you came into the regular section in terms of... I think the basic idea here was, one, is that because of some other requirements in law, and there are states that do this, actually, it is necessary to come in and have new members of the legislature sworn in. And this would allow presiding officers, once elected, to basically, and for presiding officer elections and other elections to occur. Presiding officer and president pro tem, and the chief clerk of the House and the secretary of the Senate.
Mr. Chairman, on this referral, are we subject to the Armada limitations on the referral?
Yes, you would be, and I think we have been assured that this would actually meet an Armada test. And I will double-check that before it comes back for work session.
I'd be very interested in drilling down on that issue.
Okay.
Because I actually see more than one substantive change in this legislation.
Okay.
Thank you.
We will have that issue checked with Legislative Council. Yes, Senator Metzger.
Just ask a question following up on Senator Farioli. If the answer turns out to be any different than what we assume, right?
Yeah.
As I recall, with some other things that we had in the past, could we still move forward if there was sufficient doubt about the Armada issue as a revision, which would change the numbers to 40-20, but we could still do that if we posed it differently before the body?
Yes, you could either actually, if there is an Armada issue, you obviously could consider this as a constitutional revision, or you could actually split the measure, which might be interesting, though, given what the context of it was, into separate amendments if there are two issues contained within the bill.
And, Mr. Chairman, following up on Senator Metzger's question, will the language start out notwithstanding the Constitution?
I don't believe so. Okay. Now we have a wide throng of people that wish to testify.
I
we
think
don't
that,
know if we have enough time left.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I think that shows the broad base of support for annual sessions in Oregon.
Well, I can tell you, having... Well, we won't go into that.
Yeah, we won't go into that.
A wise choice, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Ms. Miller, if you would please proceed, identify yourself for the record.
Yes.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, thank you for letting me join this crowd today. My name is Andy Miller. I'm a senior policy analyst for Oregon Business Association. Our statement is simple. We believe that the annual sessions are necessary for the complexity of budgeting mostly, and we do support the, I was glad to hear the amendment that put the time certain on it. The question, one of the questions that has been asked to me, because as you see, not many of my colleagues chose to join me in this effort today, was the content of what, is there any discussion about the content of the what would be allowed in the 45-day session?
Okay. If I might comment on that, and obviously other members here would comment also, the idea in crafting the constitutional amendment was to enable future legislatures, not to bind them, so that based upon the circumstances that they might face, obviously you might be devoted largely to budget issues in the short session, you might be a combination of budget issues and policy issues. Your forecast might be all on track, and you maybe don't need to do any revisions to the budget at all, and you could be devoted to policy. I would tell you one of the concerns that I have, and it comes from our experience in these supplemental sessions, more this one than the last one actually, is that the 45 days I think is an adequate time for the supplemental session, hoping that it actually would be a little bit shorter than that. These 28-day sessions, trying to complete them, because that's what you have to do with a 28-day session, trying to complete them in 22, 23 days so you can make 28 days, is a little too short, because it, particularly if you take up policy issues, because it means that there is not enough time to actually come back and to basically revisit something, to basically take it back and revise it. We are on such short time schedule within this session that literally, as you know, we open on the 1st, on the 4th, something has to be scheduled in a committee either prior to that or after that, prior to the 11th. And then it has to be out of the a chamber's committee of origination by the 11th. Those timelines are a little bit too tight for policy issues. That's my own personal perception, that you don't really get to come back. However, stating that in another way too, I think it's incumbent on people in the legislature in a short session to do much more homework if they're going to produce a measure for the session, to have basically worked with impacted parties long before the session ever starts, so they know what the issues will be and they have tried to address those issues. I mean, this is our second attempt. And so you kind of see these things. And I've always considered this like a trial, not like a trial like guilty or not guilty, a trial like seeing what works and what doesn't work. And I just think that these sessions for policy, when you say they're 28 and you're trying to complete them in 21, 22, 23 days, it's too short.
Chair Devlin, may I comment on that?
Yes.
It's been my experience with this new arrangement. The interim hearings grouped together were very helpful for those of us who were trying to plan our time, and you could, you know, really get a lot of things done. The downside on that was, in this session, a lot of things that were introduced had been heard, but not necessarily by all the people that needed to hear them. And there are some examples that I won't give specifics unless you really need them, but where people have not had the time to make their case when there was a contentious issue.
Right.
And I think that that's problematic. So if you're going to have a lot of this forework done, you have to make sure you allow a good time for a public hearing during that 45-day session. Yeah. And that has not happened this session.
Well, and I think that's one of the issues that I think why many of us believe that if you're going to do this short session, that it has to be at least about 40 to 45 days.
That was, Chair Devlin, that was our thought as well.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I have very strong feelings about this issue. And you touched on some of the worst features of this proposal. First of all, to suggest that you could have a pre-session session, which doesn't count against the clock, and then limit legislators to the issues that they may uptake in that pre-session session, is utterly fictitious. It's a flight of fancy.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If I may proceed, utterly fictitious and a flight of fancy. The short time that the chairman and the OBA has pointed out as a deficiency has led to work groups that exclude and not include people who have dissenting opinions. And that exclusionary process has led to some really tortured constructs. We're seeing some of that play out here in the issues that are attendant to the good time discussions that we're having in the justice system, in the prison system. What we're seeing is the dissent that would normally be encouraged, the airing of which creates better public policy, simply being excluded. And that's possible given the makeup of the legislature, and what that leads to is we're going to be seeing legislation come to the floor that has never had a public hearing. It has been taken to a committee, wordsmithed by a group of folks who are not being held accountable for allowing public input, run back to the floor and passed possibly on partisan or majority party politics. That's not the way this process is designed to work. That's the reality. That isn't theoretical. We're seeing it now. And what we're about to do is offer people a sugar-coated version of what this departure from our standard practice and the constitutional obligations, sugar-coated in regards to bringing up the exigencies of the budget or the complexity of modern society or whatever argument you want to pile onto this thing. While I might agree with some of those things in principle and practice, this simply is meant to grease the rails to conclusion. It leads us to a rush to judgment. It excludes public process, as we've seen. Mr. Chairman, I would hope that you would join me in opposing any piece of legislation that comes to the Senate floor that has not had a public hearing. And we're going to be seeing that stuff in this session. So, Mr. Chairman, I've got some real reservations about the way this annual session construct is being rolled out at people and packaged as an expedient thing driven by the necessities of the budget.
So. Just sort of clarification, actually, and Senator Farioli and I could sit here and debate, and actually Senator Metzger Farioli and I could sit here and debate process within this building for probably the next 3 hours.
Not during the special session, not Mr. Chairman.
But actually, in some regard, there have always been complaints about process, and rather than getting into the specific complaint here, that's occurred whether it's in a regular session or a short supplemental session or a special session. I think one of the issues that Senator Farioli is highlighting is actually probably maybe not in terms of how Senator Farioli feels about it in terms of process, but actually is probably an item that testifies to the importance of having a supplemental session, and that is the measure relative to modifying our earned time provisions. I think most members of the legislature believe how the earned time was implemented was not what we had hoped it would be. And if we had not coming back into a supplemental session, we would have not been addressing that issue in 2010. We would have been addressing that issue in 2011. To also clarify, just because in this organizational session, you could potentially just have the introduction of bills, that does not mean under any of the discussions that we'd have that would be bills would be limited to being introduced at that time. They could obviously still be introduced in the regular session. So I think it was just an issue about whether or not during the organizational session, it's not actually been spoken of in this constitutional amendment, but I guess theoretically you could do first readings of bills. You just couldn't take any action on them. So,
Mr. Chairman, I think we need a constitutional scholar, because I don't believe that you can have the legislature in session and limit the action that can be taken by chairs during a pre-session session.
Okay. We can get that clarified, Senator Farioli.
Okay.
Senator Metzger, did you have any comments, sir?
No, not really.
Okay. Well, it's been a lengthy a lengthy amount of testimony today on this bill.
Chair Devlin, if I may just reinforce that we still, with the reservations that we both have cited, support annual sessions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chairman, just, you know, not to belabor the issue, but when was this public hearing posted?
This one was posted probably yesterday, would be my guess.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, this agenda was posted late afternoon on Tuesday after we realized we didn't get to the meeting that day.
I remember that. Well, I think we were discussing
yes, lengthy appointments and
some
lengthy
issues of independent thinking and possibly undue influence on board members. Mr. Chairman, I think you could, without fear of contradiction, characterize this as the most significant change in the Oregon Constitution since it was adopted. Well, and obviously the Mr. Chairman, but then again, dissent and contradiction is always a feature in our process. It's a big change, and it literally will affect every citizen's rights in the state of Oregon. And yet, we have one person representing one organization. And Mr. Chairman, is this the only public hearing we'll have before this bill?
No, it is not.
So we'll have another public hearing.
Yeah, we will have a public hearing before we go to a work session on the bill.
I would hope that because of the significance, notwithstanding, you know, the women's vote is also an extremely significant change.
Some of the things we've repealed are relatively significant also.
True, but to decide to go from biannual to annuals, two-year biennial sessions to annual sessions is a pretty big deal. I would expect more people to be engaged in this process.
Yeah.
I think that it just speaks to the issue that folks aren't really watching what's happening in this building.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
Is there anything else for the good of the order? If not, we're adjourned. Mm-hmm.